Welcome to the Bowhunter Podcast. All bow hunting, all the time. Now, here's your host, Associate Editor Mark Demko.
So hey everybody, welcome to the Bowhunter Podcast, presented by Lancaster Archery Supply. For all your bow hunting needs, visit lancasterarchery.com. We've got the gear, we've got the knowledge, we've got the passion. Well, we're here at the end of March, and in a couple of the southern states, turkey season is just open. Of course, Florida's been open for several weeks, but the rest of the country is going to be following suit, such as the Northeast and the Midwest. And always get excited at this time of the year to talk turkey. And I have two great gentlemen from the National Wild Turkey Federation who have joined us this week. So I'd like to welcome Derek Alkar. Derek, you're from the southern part of the country, and Ryan Boyer, you're from the Midwest, biologist with the NWTF. Thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having us.
Yes. So we're going to talk about a lot. We're going to do a bit of a preview. And then this past year, the NWTF launched a major initiative that both of you were part of called the Habitat for the Hatch. We're going to dive into that. But let's start with a bit of a preview as far as what hunters can expect. Now, Derek, we'll start with you. You're in the southern part of the country. I think you basically cover, if I remember this correctly, Alabama, Kentucky, and Tennessee.
That's correct. Yes, sir.
Now, obviously, that's one of the areas of the country where we've seen turkey numbers change and decline in the past, say, 10 to 15 years. But let's look at it from a broader view. Right now, how would you assess the bird populations in your part of the country? You do a lot of work out in the woods, in the field, and so you get a pretty good handle on what's going on because you work with the state conservation and wildlife agencies as well.
Yes, sir. We have a lot of great partners that we're working with on a daily basis, from the state wildlife agencies to federal agencies. But when you look at the turkey populations in my area, and I would say this can probably be extrapolated to the Southeast, as a whole, things have been on a decline for several years when you look at recruitment data, when you're looking at things like poult per hen, which is how many little ones we're getting into the population. So when you look at that data at a landscape scale, you start to see some declines. But I will tell you that it depends on where you are, because there are pockets in, you know, the from the Alabama line to Nashville, through Tennessee, there are large landowners that are doing habitat management the right way, and they got more turkeys than they've ever had. But that's not at scale. And when you think about what wildlife agencies are tasked with, they're managing at state level. So, you know, we have all those good areas, but then we also have some areas that, like the Delta, for example, you know, the Mississippi Delta can be impacted really heavily by flooding, and had a few of those. Not last year's drought condition, but before that, you know, we have a couple bad years of weather and you're flooded. So as a whole, things have been on the decline, but the people that are doing their habitat management right and really out there working for the bird still have some good populations.
Yeah, thank you. And I think you're going to find that no matter where you are. One time, the Midwest, Nebraska and Kansas was like, everybody told me it's ridiculous. Like if you found a block of woods, you were going to find birds. And obviously they've seen declines. And now, Ryan, you and I live a little closer. I live in Pennsylvania. You live in Michigan. And so you cover the Midwestern region of, I think, Ohio, Indiana, and Michigan. And before I ask you how the birds are doing, I'll say it's very similar to what you were saying, Derek. Even within Pennsylvania, we have areas where the birds have declined pretty substantially, but then we have the southwestern part of the state, and believe it or not, the northeastern part of the state, where you still find good bird numbers. And like you said, if people are doing habitat work, if they're doing you know, food plots and enhancements and things like that, it can really vary and be really quite strong. But Ryan, what are you seeing in your area? I mean, as far as like when you're out there and talking to people, how are the bird numbers in the area you cover?
Yeah, so you know, we're seeing in comparison regionally in the upper Midwest, you know, we haven't seen the precipitous declines that parts of the southeastern United States have in more recent years. But with that being said, you know, each one of my three states are a little bit different in terms of, you know, some of the challenges that they've seen. In Ohio, for instance, with the exception last year, we saw a pretty significant bump in harvest in 2023 from 2022, and But the 4 years prior to that, we were seeing pretty significant declines in harvest happening across the state. So it was a cause for concern with the agency from that perspective. And so they've tried to implement some changes to help take some of those outside pressures off off the birds within, you know, their capacity, what the agencies can do, the limited levers that they have that they can pull. And so they've reduced the bag limits more recently for spring harvest and restricted fall harvest a little bit there in Ohio. But we did see a bump last year in harvest, and I think was probably pretty closely tied to the cicada hatch that took place and covered parts of southern Ohio 2 years later. And it created a bump in the number of two-year-old gobblers that were harvested last year. But Indiana, the same thing. We saw a record harvest actually last year. And going to be curious to see what we would expect to see in Indiana. Indiana's been a little bit more stable in terms of spring harvest over the last 5 to 10 years. Would venture to say that we're probably going to come down off of last year's harvest and probably stabilize a little bit to what it was the prior year before. And in Michigan, and harvest in Michigan's come down since about 2008 is when it peaked. Again, we saw an increase in harvest there during 2020 with COVID, an increased number of hunters out on the landscape. There wasn't a whole lot else you could do. So we expected to see an increase in harvest there where you see increase in effort. But Michigan's somewhat stable and has been stable for the last couple of years, around 30,000 birds being harvested. So we're still seeing some fluctuations, but not as significant declines from peak harvest rates that we're seeing in other parts of the country.
And that's certainly good news. And I've actually seen that. I've looked at some of the forecasts from some of the other states, and they said they're at least stable now, maybe not going up substantially, but stabilized. One of the things I really want to talk about is this new initiative you have. It's actually a 10-year initiative to really enhance habitat for turkeys for as far as nesting and raising the brood and things like that. And I think that's important because it's called Habitat for the Hatch. And I think you're probably working with a lot of partners, and both of you have worked on this initiative, getting it off the ground and getting started. But it seems like a major, massive undertaking. I think you're trying to really improve like about 1 million acres, if I'm correct. And so let's start with you, Derek, because a lot of this is going to be done in the Southeast. But talk about sort of how this came to be. What was the genesis behind this Habitat for the Hatch?
Yes, sir. Yeah, it's a 10-year initiative, as you mentioned. It's got several goals in there that we'll kind of talk through here in a minute. But how it started is that these declines discussions that we're having right now. It was, hey, we're seeing these things. What are some common themes, and what are some things that we can look at to have an effect on nesting and brooding? And in the Southeast, it's a little bit different than in the North. You know, we don't have hard winters. We're not losing birds through the winter. The important time for our turkeys is, you know, March to July, getting them nested out of their eggs into the trees so that they can get away from predators and things like that. And when we started looking and having conversations across the Southeast, there was a couple things that stuck out to us. And the main one was, we have a lot of acres of closed canopy forest. Most of the landowners that I visit, a lot of the public lands, it's beautiful timber, but it's more like a park. You can see a long ways out through there. There's not a lot of sunlight reaching the ground. So what we wanted to do was to create an initiative that really emphasized getting sunlight to the forest floor. And that's the whole goal of this, is to get sunlight to the ground to create nesting and brooding habitat in areas of close proximity, so that, you know, if a poult hatches, it doesn't have to go a mile to get to some really quality habitat, because it's dead poult walking if it has to do something like that. The other side to this was thinking about, what are our research needs for the wild turkey? And we know there's a lot of research going on right now about survival rates. And, you know, we have autonomous recording devices out there getting gobbling rates and different things like that. But we really wanted to focus on the habitat side of things. So the research that we're working to develop will be looking at some practices that we recommend. And we know they're good for turkeys, like prescribed burning, timber thinning, edge feathering, things like that. We really wanted to try to put some hard numbers on what that looks like and what that equates to. So if you are doing this on your property, you can expect to see what? Or how does the turkey population respond to those type of habitat practices? So it's kind of twofold from the, hey, we really want to get sunlight on the ground, and then we want to understand the effects of those practices on turkey populations.
Now, is that something where you're going to be doing work with different partners on, say, both public and private land, so wildlife management areas as well as private land managers and things like that? Because obviously, most of the country is in private land, so you've got to sort of make that impact across the board.
Absolutely. Yes, sir. It's going to be a dual approach with private and public land. As you mentioned, most of the Southeast is in private land. Well, most of the East, I guess, is in private land management. And that's going to be really important. And, you know, in the Southeast, we have a lot of, you know, TIMOs and REITs, which are the large timber companies and things like that, that many hunters in the Southeast that lease out property. You know, they don't necessarily own it. So we want to make sure that the research that we're doing is applicable to a lot of different landowner types.
Thank you. Now, Ryan, actually, this project comes into the very southern end of your district or region. I think southern Ohio, maybe Indiana a little bit. Are you doing some similar projects up there, or will you be undertaking similar projects? Let's talk about a little bit of some of the work that's happening up in that Midwestern region.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. Part of the geographic extent of the Habitat for the Hatch initiative does come into parts of Southeast Indiana as well as Southern Ohio, and two areas and strongholds for wild turkey restoration and maintain some of the highest levels of wild turkey harvest for us. So like Derek was saying, one of our greatest opportunities to help try and influence production, ultimately putting more turkeys on the landscape, maintaining desirable numbers and helping our agency partners do that is through habitat management and using the best available science to drive those types of things. So largely our priorities and our focuses are within our focal landscapes where we prioritize our work is largely focused on improving breeding season habitat for wild turkeys. So getting the sunlight to the forest floor and start incorporating disturbance that's important for the early successional habitat. So regeneration of those native grasses and wildflowers, things that are going to help bring in an abundance of insects, which those hens and poults need during the breeding season and provide adequate cover for them. There's certainly, you know, it's Derek and I, we and our counterparts across the country assess their greatest needs. We have to make that determination and figure out what sort of management practices are needed to help that bird, depending on what part of the annual cycle we're talking about. But our arguably one of our largest focuses throughout much of the country is trying to impact habitat that's going to benefit that bird during the breeding season.
Yeah, and habitat is one part of the puzzle. I should ask both of you, what are some of the other factors that are sort of maybe impacting turkey numbers? We know turkey, for example, are a prey animal. We know that our weather is changing drastically, our climate is shifting and things like that. So maybe what are some of the other factors that are impacting the population in addition to maybe habitat quality?
Well, I think you hit on a couple of them there. Weather is definitely one, and depending on where you are, can be a huge one. As we mentioned earlier, in the Delta around the Mississippi River, if you're in any of these areas that flood, Western Tennessee, they created a new zone to manage turkeys over there because of the impacts of flooding. You mentioned, you know, turkeys are a prey species, and predators we know have an impact on wild turkeys. When you look at some of the nesting success rates, it's dismal. It's a wonder we have any turkeys. If you look at some of the numbers around, you're talking about some areas have 80% nest loss, and that might be a good year. And we know that the biggest culprit to that is predators. And, you know, some of the ways that we try to mitigate that is, number one, through the habitat management side of things, which is why we wanted to concentrate on it, is that if you start to implement habitat management practices, you are actually deterring predators from being there on the landscape where the wild turkeys are nesting. So there's some things that you can do from that side of things. And then once you have everything right, then you can start to implement some trapping to just add kind of that sprinkles on the top of your ice cream there a little bit to really put it over the top. So those are just a couple other factors that are impacting birds.
Yeah. And go ahead, Ryan, I don't know if you want to add anything, but I also had a question for you. And that is, you know, you talked about maybe changes in the bag limit and stuff for turkeys in different states. In the states, it, obviously you have biologists working for the NWTF across the country, but in talking to them, have you found that maybe some of these shortening of the seasons and changing the bag limits have had a positive impact?
Yeah, so I guess like Derek was saying, I'll tie that into that question in terms of how we work with state agencies and how they can try and manipulate levers to take pressures off of birds or increase opportunity with that. But the population dynamics specific to wild turkeys, it's, you think about it as a really big web. Hunting, certainly, we have to account for how that impacts wild turkey populations and how many birds can be removed to still be able to sustain a viable population. Like Derek was saying, our primary drivers to try and influence it as a conservation organization are largely through habitat management, but we're also trying to help support research that focuses on disease. We're looking at how disease may impact reproduction and efforts, nest success, et cetera. Understanding the predator-prey dynamic. There's a lot of things out there in the landscape, as many of us well know, that want to eat either the hen while she's placing an intensive effort and incubating nests, or the eggs, or the poults, and not always is there overlap or alignment. So, understanding those different components, changes in land use, landscape. We've seen a significant loss in the amount of CRP acres across the country. Changes in development. So things that maybe would have been really good brood-rearing habitat have now maybe turned into a parking lot or shopping center. So there's a lot of different factors there in assessing. And a lot of the research right now that we're seeing coming out are showing that, nest attempts and hens sitting on nests is now taking place and hatch rates are expanding beyond a considerably much longer part of the breeding season being extended much further out than it ever used to be. So the reproductive strategy of turkeys is ideally get as many of those females bred and sitting on nests at one point to try understanding that a proportion of those, let's say 75% of those, are going to be lost to some sort of impacts of predation, let's say. But knowing the likelihood is going to survive. But now that we're seeing some of that being extended out to further time periods, the increased risk is expanded. So it's like if you were to go in and have a buffet that's open from 12 to noon, you've got a limited opportunity to be able to go in there and eat. Whereas, you extend that from noon to five, those resources, that food availability from a predator standpoint just increased tremendously. So we're seeing some changes in terms of birds initiating nests at much later dates than what we have historically during the restoration phase of things. But, to get back and to tie that into your other question too, we work hand in glove with our state agencies, and we work really closely. We actually, there's a technical representatives committee that we work with. So it's all of the wild turkey biologists across the country that make up this technical advisory committee. And, uh-huh. and they go through and host these meetings and identify what some of the biggest constraints are, concerns, challenges. And it's through those efforts that we can better understand that, help drive and support and answer research questions. But trying to understand what role hunting plays. Certainly state agencies are challenged mm-hmm. by wanting to maximize opportunity for hunters, right? Like all of us that we enjoy it, but not to the extent where it could potentially jeopardize the resource that we all care about. A lot of the data that we have and the initial research that was done during the restoration phase, we're coming to find out that it's outdated. We need to, some of that data that was published, like Healy and Powell, for instance, one of the guidebooks that Derek and I have read and all of our counterparts in the state agencies mm-hmm. used to understand population dynamics and help set season structures. A lot of the data that was put in there, like nest success rates, poult survival, et cetera, were likely much higher than what we're seeing across the landscape today. So with that, our understanding of the level of take or the amount of birds that could be removed through fall seasons and spring seasons likely needs to be adjusted and or assessed to see if the rates that we use during the restoration era are applicable today. So We are, you know, we're seeing some changes. Some state agencies are moving their seasons back, pushing their start dates back to more closely align with the onset of the nest incubation initiation dates for females to try and help take some of those pressures off those birds earlier in the season. And some are limiting bag limits to help take some of those pressures off the birds during the season too. So,
thank you for all that. And I have to back up. Just one thing you said really grabbed my attention, and that was the birds, the hens extending their nesting season. And I don't want to assume, but what is the reason for that? What are the factors that are driving them to elongate their nesting season?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And that's one of the things we're still working with our university researchers and agencies to try and make some of those determinations. That is one of the benefits of the wild turkey is that they're prolific in the sense that they can have multiple nesting attempts throughout the season. But typically, research shows that the likelihood of the success of hatching a viable nest and rearing poults goes down with each nesting attempt. Certainly we're looking at things in terms of change in weather patterns that might delay that. Is there a human disturbance component and a human pressure aspect of it? Is there a change in terms of how the common nest predators or predators of females might be influencing some of that to expand to push those season dates back even further? So I'd say a lot of that is still being assessed, but I think it's probably a combination of multiple factors we're looking at there. And I'd have Derek jump in and provide some more details, certainly.
Yeah, I'm not so sure I can add too much to that, Ryan. I think you're spot on there, and I will say that technology has changed over time. When yes. Ryan was talking about some of the research that was maybe a little outdated, there's new technology in there. When you think about the radio telemetry that we have access now, you can put a GPS on a hen or a gobbler and every spot that they're going to. So that has really changed the research that is out there. I think we're learning more about the way that turkeys are operating. Whereas if you mm-hmm. see multiple birds together, maybe only one of them is a breeding bird. If you shoot that one, the other ones don't necessarily just, hey, I'll start breeding the next day. There's a little bit more complexity to what that looks like that could be affecting some of these things as well. Yeah. And that's why the research component of Habitat for the Hatch and other research that's going on is so important to help us understand some of those things in an ever-changing landscape with the land use changes, but also in technology, because people are amazing and the technology just keeps advancing that allows us to do our jobs even better.
Yeah. And you have to make the assumption that the research and the data and the technology, you're probably getting more accurate information than ever before, just because you have the capabilities now where we're at here in the 21st century.
Yep. Yeah. And it's, a lot of those things and assumptions, like Lovett Williams as a famous author and turkey researcher in Florida, a lot of the things that he was saying back then were actually pretty spot on when you look at what the research is telling us right now. So, it's not only learning from mm-hmm. some of those things, but it's really validating some of the assumptions that we thought.
Yeah. Well, obviously it's not all doom and gloom. You both touched on it in different ways that there are places where turkeys are still doing really, really well. And so a couple of things I wanted to ask you in regards to that. And let's stick with you for this to start, Derek. What are some great success stories in the Southeast? Have you done some habitat initiatives where you've really seen the birds sort of rebound in, say, a management area, a forest, or even a block of private landowners?
Sure. Well, there's a couple examples that I could probably give. I'll start out with, actually, neither of them are in my region, but they're in the Southeast. I used to be part of the team in Florida for a little while, mm-hmm. and we have a gentleman named Mr. Ricky Lackey, who's our district biologist down there now. But we were working very heavily with the water management districts at the time. And the water management districts, in some of them were open to hunting, some of them were not. That was just dependent on the habitat type and those kind of things. But what we were able to do is go in with them, and we partnered on some thinning of pine stands. So they had some overstock pines. We were able to go in there and thin, and then follow that up with prescribed fire. Well, after we did that, the turkeys responded so much so that they opened a hunting season out there, and we were able to see some success. Like, I was able to be on a hunt out there with some youth hunters that harvested birds. And 5 years earlier, that you wouldn't even seen a bird, let alone harvested a bird. So, you know, that's just an example of where we went into an area and were able to do some habitat manipulation that the birds responded to. The other ones I would say is that you're starting to hear a lot about prescribed burn associations, or PBAs, sometimes they're called. So when you think about the private land side of things, and landowners are really teaming up to work together. We know that turkeys in many cases have a large home range. So unless you're a large landowner, that bird's going to be somewhere else at some point in the year. You hope it's not during the spring when the season opens, but if you're working together as a unit with your neighboring landowners, these prescribed burn associations have been really helpful in getting more fire on the ground. And within the Habitat for the Hatch area, that's one of the main tools that we have, and one of the better tools and the most cost-effective tool that we have to get quality habitat on the ground. So we're seeing some areas like that that are coming together and really having an impact.
Awesome. And now, Ryan, I have to assume you have some similar stories. There's probably some areas that you work on or some groups you work with where they're seeing some good success with birds and improving habitat and things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and to dovetail right into some of the examples that Derek provided, you know, we as our district biologist, Derek, myself, and our counterparts, we've got somewhat quite a bit of variability in terms of our programs and how we can be effective in doing things. And on the ground habitat implementation, working with our state and federal agency partners is certainly a great example. And one that I can think of off the cuff here is we've got several million dollars over the last few years invested in partnering with our U.S. Forest Service on the Manistee National Forest. And the focus of that project is oak savanna habitat. So it's a transitional habitat between open grasslands and closed canopy forests. And it meets right there in the middle. And the beauty of that is it has that understory component that's rich in native grasses and wildflowers. So in terms of providing quality habitat for wild turkeys, it's really It's a tremendous habitat type that we've focused on, and it's an imperiled habitat type that we've lost much of across the country. And for those reasons, there's a lot of species still dependent on it. And we've been able to generate interest on that project specifically to bring in more than 60 different partners, from brewing companies to truck driving companies, NGOs are typical partner organizations have provided funding. Private landowners have come in on it, and we've been able to take that project and expand it out into private lands. And it's one of the most, you know, now sought after areas and districts on the forest in terms of where a lot of public land hunters like to go. And we maintain pretty high levels of harvest there each spring. In some other areas and parts of my district, let's say in southern Indiana, using this as an example, the political culture associated around timber harvest, for example, is challenging. I think this is an area where we've focused a lot of effort here more recently in trying to educate the general public and increase our outreach impact to let folks know that we need that necessary disturbance on that landscape. We need a diversity in forest age class and the interspersion of those openings, why it's good for wild turkeys. It's good for white-tailed deer. It's good for all of these other game and non-game species. And we're supporting that. And so the importance of political advocacy and the roles that we play as an organization on that is critically important and can sometimes impact larger swaths of acres. You know, we talked about the farm bill, for instance. That's something, you know, we've got some of our counterparts like Mitch Blake in Pennsylvania there, who's on our internal team looking at farm bill and helping advocate on policies that'll help private landowners. We have a nationwide national forestry initiative. We've got nearly 30 private lands that's a cooperative position between the Natural Resources Conservation Service and the National Wild Turkey Federation. generation, but we hire these cooperative foresters, and they work with private landowners to develop forest management plans and implement that type of habitat work. So there's such a broad swath in terms of examples of successes and ways that we're trying to move the needle for wild turkeys, and it's not consistent, I guess, between each of our districts and across regions, for sure.
I have to imagine that in those situations where you have blocks of landowners, much like quality deer management, but we have blocks of landowners who want to improve turkey hunting, and you have a private consultant, and you must see some pretty good results with some of that work.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And opportunities where we can be engaged on the front end and having those conversations with those landowners to make sure that we can meet their needs and their desires. We understand that first and foremost, as we're going through that process, then our foresters or wildlife biologists can add that additional input and make sure that they're going to see those outcomes. And especially if they're focused on improving habitat for wild turkeys.
Yeah. And so it sounds like there's a lot of things going on, and obviously the next few years are going to be crucial with all the research projects that are going on. And I'm guessing none of them are just a year. They're usually 2 and 3 and 4 year studies, but looking forward to a lot of positive outcomes out of all of this, and then the habitat work and things like that. But let's shift focus a little bit. You guys turkey hunt, I turkey hunt. Derek, I think you're primarily a gun hunter. Ryan, I think you hunt with both bow and shotgun for turkeys. So we'll have a couple fun questions here, and I'm going to ask both of you. Derek, let's start with you. What are your must-haves in your turkey hunting arsenal outside of your calls and your shotgun?
Well, it sounds like I need you and Ryan to take me, because you guys are bow hunting turkeys. That's why I stick to the gun, because I'm not good enough to use a bow. Yeah. But when I think about what are my must-haves, one is I want a comfortable seat, because I am squirmy as all get out, which is probably why I'm not very successful. But having the ability to sit down and be patient and take a little bit of time is crucial. The other things that I will say that might be overlooked is, especially in the Southeast, is probably permethrin or something to spray down your clothes for ticks and mosquitoes and things like that, because one, it's a health issue, and we're starting to see more cases of Lyme disease and other things like that associated with ticks. But it's also one of those things, talking about sitting still. If you got mosquitoes buzzing your face and things like that, yeah, it is very hard to sit still. And in the South, boy, oh boy, that's where the turkeys are. So you got to be prepared for those things. So those are a couple of things that I never leave home without.
Yeah, and I appreciate it. I'm glad you said that about, as I mentioned earlier, I live in Pennsylvania. Ticks have been brutal up here for a long, long time. And I don't know, it's been 20 years. I just make sure that I cover myself with something like permethrin or something. Just make sure that I'm covered, because it's just rough to go out there, especially in the spring. But we don't want to go off topic too much. Ryan, what are your must-haves in your turkey hunting arsenal outside of your calls and your weapon? There's probably a couple of things you can't leave home without.
Yeah, I was going to mimic that in terms of saying I got a thermocell that I keep in my gear. I'll tweak my kit depending on the type of hunt and what's expected. Or Derek was just saying earlier, I was taking a new hunter out, or respective, if I know I'm going to be hunting a chunk of private land that I'm going to have to myself, it's a big block, or if I'm going to shift and maybe do more of a run and gun, I tweak my kit. But having, like you said, like Derek nailed it, the ability to be able to sit still and do so comfortably. We've seen such tremendous advances in hunting clothing and that technology there. That's really, really helping you, but certainly things that are going to keep you safe too. So I don't think, in terms of having permethrin or permethrin treated gear and your thermocell, anything, yeah, in terms of concealment and being comfortable is a critical piece you can't leave home without.
Yeah. Now we mentioned just a couple minutes ago that you hunt with both the firearm and the bow. I was just curious, what makes you jump back and forth, or what prompts your decision whether you're going to go with a shotgun versus the bow?
Yeah, I think for me, a lot of that's scenario based. We feel pretty blessed in Michigan, especially in parts of northern Michigan where we are here. We've got pretty large chunks of public ground, but also getting access and permission from private landowners too. think about it in terms of the type of the hunt and how much time I might have during the season to be able to get out. Certainly try and allot myself more time chasing birds during a season with archery equipment versus going after them with a shotgun. So for me, it's largely just scenario based and where I might be going for that day or which part of the state I might be hunting in and pursuing them. But, you know, certainly public land hunting, regardless of whether you're hunting with a shotgun or archery equipment, can certainly add its own levels of challenges. But that's what sort of dictates it for me, how much time I have available and what my setups might be like for where I'm going.
Yeah. And what do you think is the biggest difference between hunting with a shotgun versus a bow? Obviously, there's factors such as distance and decoys and things, but is there anything that you really stands out to you as far as being different when you're out there with the bow than with the shotgun?
I think that distance aspect, wild turkeys have such keen eyesight. It's remarkable, and it's on full display too when you're trying to dupe them during the breeding season, that, you know, it's a feat to kill a gobbler with a shotgun, you know, any legal weapon for that matter, but to be able to do it with archer equipment too requires its own set of challenges. You've got to increase that proximity to that bird, or at least I choose to do so, and based on my level of comfortability and my competence, it amplifies that woodsmanship skills in my mind, in terms, especially, you know, depending on if you're using a blind or a homemade blind, or you're trying to, use natural cover, to be able to get away with some of that movement, but just the intricacies in terms of how a hunt might play out and trying to dupe that bird to be able to get away with that additional movement to come to full draw, places all of those additional challenges, and it amplifies any move that you might make. So I enjoy chasing a bird, and any bird that I have an opportunity to harvest in the spring, shotgun or bow, it's a lot of fun. But being able to do it with archery equipment and having that encounter come in that much closer, typically, and there's a threshold, and Derek can attest to this too. I feel like with modern technology, with our ammunition, for instance, and our turkey shotguns, and paired with a really good choke, those patterns are so constricted at shorter ranges, where there's an optimal threshold for me where, at 40 yards, 30 to 40 yards, being a pretty ideal. And as that bird starts to get inside of that into more typically what I would say like 10 to 20 yards, what I would shoot for turkeys with archery equipment, that pattern starts to get so fine and so restricted that in most cases, in a same scenario, comparing apples to apples, I'd want to kill that bird at 25, 30 yards before it gets in too tight. Whereas, I still need that bird to commit another 5-10 yards in an archery scenario. And that increases that opportunity for me as the hunter to make that mistake or move at the wrong time. It also adds that additional level of excitement too, if you're able to make it work and get a bird with archery equipment.
Yeah, no doubt. And you touched on concealment being so important, but I had one other question for you in regards to bow hunting for turkeys. And that is, do you use your regular whitetail setup? I'm assuming you deer hunt. Or do you tweak it? Like, for example, do you use different type of broadhead? Do you maybe use guillotine broadheads? Is there anything you change from your normal setup with your bow?
That's a great question. I've done both. It was part of an argument, not an argument, but my how I got the approval to purchase a new bow previously with my wife. I worked out the deal that my backup bow was going to be my archery bow for some turkey hunting. It seemed to work at the time. So I dabbled with, dropping some of the poundage down from maybe a typical 70-pound draw weight to something in the 60 to 65 range for hunting turkeys. I like shooting my bow all year round. So I don't have an issue using my whitetail setup for turkey hunting as well. And just because of my familiarity with it and bouncing from a different bow. The guillotine style broadhead, certainly, that's one of the decisions I think you have to make as you're going into whether or not you're going to archery hunt for turkeys, as to whether or not you want to target heads or you want to, body shots. So like the Magnus, I think it's the bullhead, maybe the broadhead. Used those before. And, in terms of body shots, the bird I killed a couple of years ago with my bow was a vital shot, and I was using the G5 Mega Meat one of those, the expandable three blade broadhead scenarios. But I've got it's a Matthews Phase 4 29 inch axle to axle. I like typically longer ones, but with that bow, the riser length just really outdoes itself compared to what, you know, previous 29 inch axle to axle bows were. So I feel like it's a good marriage for me for bow hunting whitetails. It's still it's a good mix. It's some people choose to hunt out of ground blinds too, with a decoy type scenario, and a shorter axle to axle bow seems to work pretty well for me there. So I don't wouldn't say I really tweak too much. Just shoot what I know I'm really confident in, and being able to hit those targets and have a good understanding of what wild turkey's anatomy are if you're looking at body shots, because the potential for crippling loss or wounding birds can be pretty high, and making sure that you understand where those vitals are and practicing scenarios is critically important.
Yeah. And I appreciate you touching on that, because it is crucial with turkeys and, you know, it happens to bow hunters. Sometimes if, you know, you have to make sure you understand your shot placement, but where the vitals lay in the bird, and also factor in the feathers and all that factor. I'm going to leave you guys in 1 minute. You guys have been awesome, but I have one last question. I actually want to hear from both you and Derek. We're going to start with you, and it'll be the same question for both of you. What is your favorite or best turkey hunting memory ever? Whether it's you, something with your family, or even if you were mentoring somebody. But Derek, I'd love to hear that from you.
Yeah, well, mine revolves around mentoring. My dad was not a turkey hunter. I did not grow up as a turkey hunter. My uncles took me a couple times, and actually the first bird I killed was a young of the year bird in the fall in West Virginia. So I have those memories, but my best memory goes back to Florida again. I spent a lot of time there, and the NWTF partner with the State Wildlife Agency on a youth hunting program of Florida. And actually an NWTF employee used to be a partner position to do that, and had the opportunity to go down and hunt Osceolas with a gentleman. He was 14, 15 years old, who was terminally ill with cancer, and got to ride on a swamp buggy down there. And he loved that. So did I. I love that part too. Got to hear them roost. They were roosted like right by the barn, which was nice. And that he harvested his first bird, and his dad got to be there with us and was part of that. And I was just amazed at the relationship, the hugs, the tears, and everything that took place between that father and a son, just taking in the moment of everything that it was worth. I felt very honored to be there, let alone have a hand in helping accomplish that. And I have so many examples of where hunting, deer hunting, or turkey hunting is really created those bonds like that with complete strangers at a hunting camp. Or, I can remember fish fries the night before at deer camp or something like that. So it's those memories that stick in my mind, but that one is one that I will never forget.
What a wonderful story. So well said. Ryan, I'm guessing you have some story that really touches you when you think back.
Yeah, admittedly, it's hard to come up with one example, because like Derek said, if you've got an opportunity to go out and all of us have that commonality of going into the field and experiencing things, God's creation and nature is tremendous, but being able to do it and see it take place through others' eyes, is probably one of the greatest gifts that I've had. And so my stories tie back to mentoring. One, I guess, would say I could cheat and pick two hunts, but one I was not on. I too, like Derek, my dad didn't grow up as a turkey hunter, wasn't afforded the opportunity when he was young. So fortunately, one of his really good friends and an avid hunter took to turkey hunting, and he was able to, pass the bug along to me, and I had the excitement as a 12-year-old and to go through that process. So it was a mentor that really developed me into the journey where I'm at now, as a turkey hunter and a turkey biologist. But, I had heard a story a year or two on with the Turkey Federation from a volunteer talking about a mentored hunt. And this gentleman had took out a young man who had lost both of his parents, and his grandparents were taking care of him, and took this kid on this hunt. And our mentor, our NWTF volunteer, was so committed and invested in trying to get this young man bird, as many of us do. Like, we focus a lot of that in the mentoring process about, you know, the harvest and that opportunity. And they get set up in the morning, the birds fly down across the field from them. They're displaying, they're gobbling, and they end up following hens across the field the other way and into the woods. And the volunteer, as he's telling me the story, he's like, man, I'm really kind of disappointed and let down. I really was hoping, you know, we thought the birds were going to do this, they did that. And, he's like, in my mind, I'm thinking about, where am I going to go next? And how are we going to cut these birds off? Or, you know, and just asking the kid, are you having a good time? Is this fun? He's like, that was, the kid replied back to our volunteer saying, that was the most amazing thing I'd ever seen. And he's like, yeah, you know, it was pretty cool. They're out there gobbling and displaying. And the young man was like, well, no, I've never actually watched the sun come up before. And the volunteer like kind of sat back. It's like, oh, you know, it was one of those moments in his mind, and him telling the story, it tripped a trigger in me here and that, going, we have these sometimes preconceived notions or ideas and what we deem as a successful hunt. And sometimes largely, you know, we've all, I think, been there. It's focused on the harvest. And in that instance, that seeing the sunrise was just what did it for that kid in that morning. And so I, you know, keep that in mind when I'm taking folks out, that it's the little things, it's the process, and they're learning, they're having fun along the way, is really what I take from some of those things. But I've had the opportunity to fortunately mentor a lot of new folks in hunting. And honestly, I took two brothers out, and one morning we got into a tremendous setup. We got in there a little late because his dad had come out with us. It was myself and two other volunteers. We're trying to get them all hidden, and the kids in ground blinds. Remarkably, the birds didn't bust. They flew down. There were six different longbeards that had come out in front of us with these hens, and they were trying to time it. I'm like, whenever you guys are ready, make sure they're separated and pick your bird out, shoot. And I could hear them in the blind, and the dad kind of coaching both boys through it, and they're both in front of them. And like, one, two, boom, the one kid shot on two, and he made a great shot. One bird was down, and the birds scattered quickly, tried to get the birds to come back, but they moved off. And the other brother that didn't shoot, he's like, we were supposed to shoot on three, Grayson. And they the one kid was pretty let down and upset, but that rest of that morning, he, to his credit, he stuck with it and took him out there with his dad. And we got a bird to fire up later that morning, and he ended up killing a tremendous bird with great spurs and a long beard. And seeing him kind of go through the trials and tribulations of the ups and downs of that hunt and stick with it, something that still sticks with me to this day. So that's like, passing it along and experiencing through other people's just awesome.
Yeah, and obviously young people are the future of the sport, but the stories you both shared, thank you so much for that, because that's a huge part. As you said, you know, sometimes we think about the success, but it's really only one component of the whole experience. But we're going to wrap up now, guys. Thank you both so much for joining us. Obviously, good luck in your hunting this spring. And for everybody who's listening who loves the turkey hunt, good luck as you get out this spring. And we'll see you all next time on the Bowhunter Podcast.
Thanks for downloading the Bowhunter Podcast. All bow hunting, all the time. Pick up the latest issue of Bowhunter Magazine on your local newsstand, or connect with us online at bowhunter.com.